down here below. The winds of change are blowing through the weary night. I pray my soul will find me shining in the morning light. Down here below, down here below, it's not so easy just to be. Sometimes I'm really all at sea. You made me when the world was new, and skies were blue. And
that's the great Abby Lincoln, born in Chicago, vocalist, songwriter, actress, and activist, with one of her many anthems, Down Here Below. That's from her 1995 album, A Turtle's Dream. Lincoln, who was married to drummer Max Roach for 8 years, from 1962 to 1970, died on August the 14th, 2010, from complications following open-heart surgery. She was 80 years old, but of course left her mark before she went. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Tuesday, August the 12th, and an uneasy calm has settled over Ferguson, Missouri, after a second night of clashes between law enforcement and local residents protesting the police shooting of 18-year-old Michael Brown. Another demonstration, however, is scheduled for today. So far, more than 50 people have been arrested in protests and rioting in several areas following Brown's death on Saturday after what police officials say was a struggle with a gun in a police squad car. Police have not said why Brown was in the car, but confirmed that at least one shot was fired during the struggle, and then the officer fired more shots before leaving the car. The FBI has opened a civil rights investigation, and St. Louis County also is investigating the shooting. Here are the parents of Michael Brown asking for justice.
Funny, silly, it make you laugh. Any problems that'll be going on or any situation, it wasn't nothing that he couldn't solve. He'll bring people back together.
Yes.
He's a good boy. You didn't deserve none of this. None of it. We need justice for our son.
Yes. Yes.
We need justice for our son.
Yes. Yes.
If you have any information, please, please give it to us.
He didn't deserve that, y'all.
We need a police report, too. We need to know everything. We want everything. We want this done. You gonna do this right? I don't want no violence. We don't want no violence.
Because Michael wouldn't have wanted no violence.
He wouldn't have wanted none of that. None of it. None of it. He would want us to do it right. That's why we're doing it right.
Amen.
We're gonna do it the right way.
That's my firstborn son. Everybody that know me knew how I felt about my son. I just wish I could have been there to help him. Anything. He didn't deserve it.
The parents of Michael Brown, Father Michael Brown, also named Michael Brown, and Mother Leslie McSpadden. One of the starkest contrasts in racial attitudes in America is in the area of policing. Whites generally have a positive view of police. They regard policing as a vital service to their communities, maintaining order and safety, and a desirable quality of life. African Americans and Latinos, however, tend to be distrustful of police. In their communities, the police are more about enforcement than the law. Personal interactions have the strongest impact on perceptions of police, says the National Institute of Justice, the research, development, and evaluation agency of the U.S. Department of Justice. People form opinions of the police based on their own interactions with them or the experiences they hear from trusted friends and family, the Institute says. Recent events involving alleged misconduct, brutality, and killings by police have sharpened the focus on the wide disparities in interactions, experiences, and perceptions of different racial groups about police and policing. What accounts for the dramatic difference in the interactions, experiences, and perceptions by these racial groups? Why do they persist? Our guest is Michael Graves. He is a retired New York Police Department officer and one of three ex-officers who co-host Community Cop on the Manhattan Neighborhood Network. He's here with us today to discuss the relationship between race and policing. He's a member, as are all three, of 100 Blacks in Law Enforcement Who Care. And Michael, good to have you with us today.
Good to be with you.
Well, let's start with this notion about the disparities in the perceptions and experiences between white community generally and African American and Latino communities. What accounts for it from your experience?
Well, certainly when we look at the whole concept of policing, you have to remember that police departments traditionally protect property, and more often than not, the property that they protect are the property of whites. The societies, whatever you deem important, whether it's economic, social justice, or these, or a whole plethora of things, the overriding decision will be made by whites. Consequently, certainly the police departments, literally every police department I've ever seen, represents some tentacle of white supremacy. And in major cities, it's no doubt that blacks have a serious, African Americans have a serious history of being very, very skeptical of the police at best. And certainly afraid that, you know, to meet a police officer 1, 2 o'clock in the morning, as opposed to whites, where it's a godsend to see a police officer 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, depending on where you're at. And there are certain areas that police officers will approach a black person, even in New York City, which is considered, you know, cosmopolitan, that a black person cannot just be walking there after 10 or 11 o'clock at night, and you'll be questioned, stopped, and, you know, that whole thing. So I would say that certainly this is not paranoia on the part of African Americans. There's a long tradition going back well over a century and a half of oppression, clear oppression, not perceived oppression, clear oppression. And when you look at some of the most brutal, graphic shootings, killings in the NYPD's history, and my personal most egregious one I've seen was Eleanor Bumpus, but, you know, you can take your pick. It's so many. But I've never heard of a 68-year-old grandmother that has chronic arthritis, in excess of 300 pounds, can barely walk, that are approached by more than a half a dozen police officers, ended up being shot with a shotgun twice. And some weak claim that she waved a knife and refused to leave her apartment, where she was several months behind in her rent, where you could very easily call her daughter, a family member, and rectify the situation. It did not have to come down to the police department versus Eleanor Bumpus.
Well, it wasn't just the police department. Remember, it was a SWAT team.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. It was emergency service cops that are called in. Emergency service cops are traditionally called in when you're dealing with a so-called emotionally disturbed person. That's what EMS does. And you would think that with EMS on the scene, that certainly they would have the tactics in place and whatever procedures in place to avoid a shooting, you know, whether you use a prong, whether you use a net. I wouldn't even come down to a stun gun and things like that. It wouldn't even come down to any type of weapon that can cause physical harm, you know, for emergency service of all things. So when you see whether it's a Sean Bell or you see a Diallo in cases like that, no black person can be accused of being paranoid or just making things up as we go along, because we are so often reminded, in case we forget, that another one looms and another one looms. And we just saw Eric Garner, and now it's opened up a can of worms, and now you have videotapings of whether what happened in Bed-Stuy, where police actually stomped a person on the head, and all these cases. Now they're looking back at complaints, and between 2009 and 2013, there's been 1,049 chokeholds, complaints, with the CCRB.
Civilian Complaint Review Board.
So you have a situation where you don't see these things, and certainly you have the mayor and you have the police commissioner going on the airwaves, and it's going all over the country, that it's a question of training. I will believe that it's training when 68-year-old white grandmothers are being shot, are being choked to death, then I'll consider it training. But as long as blacks and Latinos are the ones that are being killed ad nauseum and systematically unarmed, and that's the critical thing. Force is supposed to be commensurate with the force that's being used against a police officer in effecting an arrest. And I think I need to repeat that just in case somebody didn't get it. The force that is used is only commensurate with the force that is being used in resisting arrest. So you can't go by, because I've heard some people say that Eric Garner was a big man. He was over 300 pounds. He can be 400 pounds. If he's not using any force and his hands are up, then there's no need for that. In the stomping situation in Bed-Stuy, you know, a police officer pulled out his gun and put it in the guy's face, waved it in his face. So these tactics are not being used against whites. It's not a question of training. It is a complete and total disrespect for African Americans and Latinos, and certainly until police officers go to jail for these actions, not just being restricted to desk duty. That's not enough, because those police officers are still being paid right now, those two police officers that are right now on desk duty in the Eric Garner case. And we'll certainly get to Ferguson, Missouri, but those two police officers are just right now on desk duty. They're not suspended. They will still be able to pay all their bills. Life goes on as usual. They're on a banker's hours right now, an 8 to 4, 9 to 5. They sit down and they take a piece of paper and pass it to each other from one desk to the other, and at the end of the day they check out and let's go about their business. So that's what's being done right now. So I would just say that this so-called progressive mayor that Reverend Sharpton characterized as the most progressive New York City mayor in the last 50, 60 years, I'm wondering, who was he being compared to? Frank Rizzo? If he's that progressive, who is he being compared to?
Let me ask you about the dynamic here. In almost all of these cases, we see a common thread. The victims of these outrageous acts of violence by police, invariably, almost always, African-American and Latino. The mm-hmm. officers involved almost always are white.
Absolutely.
Now, what is it, from the 100 blacks in law enforcement who care, we have the Guardians Association, we have the Latino Officers Association. I have known many, many, many police officers and detectives. In fact, one from Harlem, the late Bill Johnson, I don't know if you remember him, but he told me that in all of his years, and he was on the force for almost 30-something years, I think, he never, ever, ever used his gun. And it was a source of pride. What is it about this dynamic that we see that the agency of the violence directed at citizens is usually almost always white male officers, and the victims, the people on the receiving end of that, mostly black and Latino? What is it that, why don't, the question is, how come black officers and Latino officers tend not to behave that way generally, and then they're not represented in this particular dynamic?
Well, here's what, from the outset, blacks and Latinos won a lawsuit a dozen years ago against the police department for $21 million for their internal racism. And they've, you know, just kind of kept that lid on that, so the average person doesn't know that. So blacks and Latinos have expressed just this internal racism. Now, with respect to what happens on the outside, I think it has much to do with, because when you see the victims are traditionally African-American and Latino, it is an expression, it is one of the highest expressions of white supremacy one can remember. If you recall, even the New Jersey governor, what's her name, Whitman, even she mm-hmm. got involved and stopped questioning Frisk during the time where they was stopping people on highways and just stopping cars driving while black. She got involved and got out, and when they pulled the person over, she made the person assume the position and search the person. So this is just fun and games. This is like hunting. I mean, this is just a barbaric form of hunting that, until white officers go to jail, they will continue. I mean, 50 shots against Sean Bell and no weapon was involved. 41 shots against Diallo, not one weapon was there being pressed against those officers. You know, so you've never heard of things like this in a white community. It does not exist. So this is not any paranoia. This is not any race baiting. I mean, it's just, you just can't deny it. It's just no getting around it that until white officers go to jail, and we don't have not one district attorney in all 62 counties in New York, and I dare say there are no district attorneys of note anywhere that will go after whites. And you seen what happened to Nifong, and he had evidence that that hockey team raped that sister in North Carolina. And look what happened to him. Look at how white elected officials from all over the country that wasn't even from North Carolina went after him like it was no tomorrow for going after whites for raping a black woman, which they feel is open game. So until we get the right lawyers in place, until we start controlling and exercising the power of the district attorney's office, because that's just not enough just to be in those offices, because we have a couple here in New York State already, but not only to be in the office, but to really control the office in the way that our people put us in that office to control and rectify these historical wrongs. Until that happens, then we could have a U.S. Attorney General that's black but silent. Black, he's there, but he's silent. We could have a president that's there, but if he's not exercising that power the correct way, then it's only having a black face in a high place.
What do you hear from Ferguson, Missouri?
Well, let me just say that it's troubling that you hear very little from law enforcement. Now, if they are not even giving you the police officer's name, that's troubling. They're not identifying his ethnicity. That's
no, they're not. They're not.
They're not giving you the basic circumstances around it. That's troubling. If all you have is to know, they're not even telling you the amount of shots right now that was fired. So if you can't get the basics, then of course the reason why, they're going to keep that under the lid. So it's troubling when a black man, unarmed, going about his business with, from what I understand, a friend, and to be told, according to reports, because you got to remember, police departments are now more sophisticated than they were during the time of the so-called Mississippi burning, you know, with the civil rights workers. They don't operate quite that way anymore, where they let you out and then 15, 20 minutes later, they putting bullets in your head on a dark road. I mean, they're more sophisticated than that, and they have public relations arm. NYPD, by the way, has the best, and L.A., I'm sure, is not far behind. But even in St. Louis, obviously, they have a public relations thing, just throwing things out there and seeing what's going to stick. But according to a couple of eyewitnesses that they interviewed, if this man was walking about his business, wherever he was walking or standing at that time, and he was told to move it by the police officer, and maybe he didn't move it fast enough for the police officer, or maybe he raised a question as to why did he have to move, or whatever happened, it translated into something physical. Well, one thing that we do know, that he was not committing a crime. Now, that part we know, because if he was committing a crime, you could bet your last dollar they would have told you he was committing a crime. So there was no commission of a crime. It was only a police officer's discretion telling this man to move it. So if that translates into a young man's death, and he was unarmed, by the way, then that only shows you that that police officer should immediately be arrested by Ferguson's police department. He's not under arrest, and I'm going to assume he's probably on death duty. I would doubt they would put him out on patrol after something like that. So he's probably on death duty in all likelihood, or at worst, suspended, but I doubt he's suspended. More like death duty. And for the feds to come in, it is not like somehow the feds became benevolent or magnanimous. They only came in because the town was getting ready to blow up because of those 2 days of violence. So it's not like Eric Holder had an epiphany. It is only because the explosion and this rebellious attitude, because the people there are fed up. There's a long history in St. Louis, so I'm going to figure it's probably a history in Ferguson, which is a suburb. It's right next to St. Louis. So if that has been the case for years and years, it was bound to happen. So now they're going to send in people who they know can control it. And it seems to be Reverend Sharpton.
What do you make of Sharpton's involvement? Let me ask you.
Well, it's curious that when I saw on television last night, Attorney Crump, who has not seemed to me distinguished himself as a great attorney, because they blew it in Sanford, and I think it was intentional, by the way, but that's just my own personal opinion, that there was never a real quest for justice.
You're referring to the Zimmerman case.
That's correct. It was just too many things that I cannot consider accidents. When you're saying things, and when you are an attorney traveling around with the parents of Trayvon Martin, and you have them saying things like race was not a factor, this was an accident, and you're saying things like that, I cannot look at you as a great attorney. As a matter of fact, I can't even look at you as a decent attorney, if an attorney at all, because the things your client should not be talking at all. And you have them talking, and they're saying things that are damaging to the case. So he looks more like a gatekeeper, you know, the truth be told. And for him to be dispatched by the National Action Network and Reverend Sharpton to St. Louis from Florida, I'm smelling something that don't smell really good. For him to be there, for him to be the one, and he has the family calling for peace and calm. And that's what the whole interview was. The interview wasn't about humanize Michael Brown for us. Well, we know he was a human being. We know he was getting ready to go to college. So the whole interview was on telling people to cool it and to be calm because they're destroying property. So to say that, and then magically they said, we need Reverend Sharpton. On cue, they said that. So I'm suspicious of this whole thing because it looks like another Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman scenario. And Trump lost big time. Crump. He lost
Benjamin
big
Crump,
time
yes.
there. I almost called him a chump, but Crump, he lost big time there. So I don't see how he would be the emissary, the one to dispatch somewhere where he not only lost, but played a role in the loss by critical error after error, which might not have been an error. It might have been intentional, it seems. So to have him to be the representative to as an ambassador or emissary to move him to St. Louis and to now be the family's lawyer, I know from Reverend Sharpton's history that when those things happen, they come in with economics. They come in and they tell a family, obviously, that's probably struggling, tried to put Michael Brown, the first one, the oldest, through college. So I know they don't have a lot of means. So I'm sure that they came in and offered to do the funeral and do all the legal stuff. So that's being done by Reverend Sharpton, manipulating this behind the scenes, because I've seen them do this. And Sean Bell, the same thing they're doing with the Garner family. They have a long history of doing that. So it's like you feel it's a godsend when somebody comes in and say they're going to be your spokesman and they're going to take care of the funeral cause and everybody in the family is going to be riding in a limo to the funeral. On the surface, that appears very nice and very decent and a very humane thing to do. But behind the scenes, it's really a power play, because forces much bigger than Reverend Sharpton on the outside is giving him marching orders, and he in turn takes advantage of a grieving family, and now he's in a position to be the king And as the king he anoints Crump, who followed his orders to the letter, and they dropped the ball in Sanford, Florida, to now. So it's all set up in a way that it's going to set up in a way that's a failure for the family.
Could you explain this opinion of yours that they dropped the ball in the Zimmerman case? How did they drop the ball?
Well, race had everything to do with this case. When the case first happened, the attorney general and the governor and the chief of police all met within a half an hour after the killing of Trayvon Martin. They all met and they all huddled and determined how this thing was going to play itself out. So John Doe'd Trayvon Martin for a couple of days, and his family didn't know where he was at, and there was no explanation. And during that time, they got all the ducks in line and was able to manipulate this case in such a way that when Reverend Sharpton, Jesse Jackson, and from the Urban League, when they got to town, and Sanford, Florida, was demanding economic boycotts. And I got that from 100 Blacks in Law Enforcement's field marshal, Eric Josie, who was there, who went there immediately. He was in the crowd, and he was there and was trying to talk to the family, but those same forces kept him from talking to the family because he was going to give them some legal advice. The first thing they reassured the white community, there was going to be no economic boycotts because the people was talking about boycotts. They wanted to target certain places. And Reverend Sharpton and Jesse and them stepped in and said there would be no boycotts of Sanford or anywhere else in Florida. This was done immediately. So this was all teamwork. And Crump played a critical role in this. And they started taking this family all over the country, speaking in forums where you could juxtapose that with an automatic that would not have allowed that family to say one word.
We're talking with Michael Graves, a retired NYPD officer and one of three ex-officers who co-host Community Cop on Manhattan Neighborhood Network. And we're talking about the relationship between race and policing. I want to come back to the Eric Garner case and to one of the things that we see common to these cases where police officers are linked to criminal activity. And in this case, of course, the criminal activity that results in the death of a civilian. What do you know of about the apparatus within a police department, a typical police department? What kinds of arrangements happen in a situation where it is perceived that it is in the interest of the department as a whole to, you know, hold firm against the demands of a community? What typically happens to galvanize support? In the case of Garner, of course, you remember not too long ago, the PBA held its news conference. The Sergeants Benevolent Association also was there. It was interesting that I saw at least two black faces among them, which was meant to show that there was a unanimity. This was not a racial thing, that there was a unanimity of agreement here. What are the mechanisms by which these police officers engaging in this kind of behavior nonetheless find comfort and support within the department?
Well, for one thing, you mentioned the PBA and its president, obviously Patty Lynch, as well as the Sergeants Benevolent Association, because there were police officers there and there was at least one identifiable sergeant there. They're going to defend the shield, but they're not alone. The police department will defend the shield. The mayor will defend the shield. The mayor has gone on record saying that he's fully confident in District Attorney Donovan in prosecuting this case. He's fully confident that he will review all of the facts of the case. There's a public relations arm. There's a friendly cooperation between the media and the police department, because had this not been a police officer that killed, the police officers that killed Eric Garner, we could easily see this as a murder, and we wouldn't even be wondering why no one is locked up now. But with police officers, I've heard you mention the 48-hour rule. Now, the 48-hour rule is gone, but it hasn't totally disappeared. It left with Diallo in 98. However, you know, that a police officer in turn has internal mechanisms where they can use trauma, use trauma as an excuse not to give a written or verbal report, and they can go to the hospital after they shoot or choke, kill someone. They can go to the hospital, and in turn, the PBA lawyers will meet them at the hospital. So you have a situation where they will be advised on the counsel not to say anything, and if they want to put something out there, if they are not creative enough to create a scenario, the PBA lawyers in turn has friends in various media outlets that can just start floating stories. So in Diallo, you didn't know what was going on, and in Sean Bell and all these kids situations, they'll put out if you have a record. So we know for the record that with Garner, he was arrested 31 times. We know that his arrest history began at 16 years old. Who put that out? The police department has friends in the media, so that's all out there. So they're not going to raise the seminal questions and go after those police officers, because there's a collaborative effort with the media, you know, the public relations arm of the NYPD, the district attorney's office, as well as the police department itself. It's a really incestuous relationship with all of them. And the bottom line is that as long as the victims are black and Latino, the white media outlets have no problem with it and will not scrutinize it the way it would be scrutinized if the situation was different. So we know that it was a chokehold. And by the way, it's not just that NYPD outlawed the chokehold. New York State bars the chokehold itself. So all law enforcement agencies in New York State, no one is allowed. So it's not like the NYPD is being magnanimous by saying it cannot use the chokehold. No one in New York State can use the chokehold. And the fact is, the media knows that full well, so they can criminalize the victim in this particular case, and the family is not sophisticated enough to know that Donovan should have immediately went after those police officers, because when all is said and done, the tape don't lie, and Pat Lynch, the PBA president, asked you to dismiss the tape and to believe the officers. But in the officers' initial report, it didn't even mention a chokehold. So all of that, you know, came out later from the videotape, and they went after the actual person who taped the whole thing, and now he has a gun charge on him, and he's locked up as we speak.
Now, in a situation like the Garner case, why is it that it seems that departmental investigations supersede the public investigation by the district attorney? In other words, why is it that a month after this killing, we still have the officers on desk duty? We still don't have a charge against them, and this despite the finding of homicide by the medical examiner. In civilian life, for the public, this is unbelievable that people would be walking around still uncharged a month after a major felony, and we are hearing from the police Commissioner Bratton, that it is first the department has to undertake an investigation. So could you give us an idea of what the priorities are? Do departmental investigations trump or supersede regular prosecutorial investigations?
Absolutely. The police department is an entity unto itself. When a white cop named Dutton killed police officer Omar Edwards, a black cop, off duty, you have never seen that level of the way they got together quickly and created a scenario. Omar Edwards was walking to his car. He had just left the precinct, walking to his car somewhere around 9 o'clock at night in Harlem. He was shot by Officer Dutton, and two other officers were there also. And allegedly someone was breaking into his car. Someone was breaking into his car. He approached that person. There is no empirical evidence to show he ever pulled his weapon. The police department, with their spin, claimed that he pulled out his weapon on Dutton, who they jumped out of their car, supposedly, and they had their guns trained on each other. But we found out from the autopsy he was shot in the back. But the mayor went on record, Mayor Michael Bloomberg, went on record saying he was shot in the chest. Police Commissioner Raymond Kelly went on record saying he was shot in the chest. He was shot twice in the back and once in his forearm. So you have a police commissioner and a big city mayor who both lied to the public, and the press know this and was never challenged by the press. So there is no real journalist in New York. So, Utrice, you have to come back to New York because there's no real press and there's no real journalistic integrity in New York, and that includes even the black newspapers, because they knew full well. We told them all what happened. No one went after Raymond Kelly. No one went after the police department. No one went after the mayor, and they outright lied in the senseless murder of a black police officer. So if they'll kill a black police officer and make it up, then what will they do to a black man who was arrested 31 times, Utrice? See, we had police officers from his precinct cry to us, tell us, please. And they were, truth be told, they were somewhat afraid and intimidated to say anything, but they asked us to get justice for Omar Edwards. They stood there on the ground on 125th Street and 2nd Avenue, watched Omar Edwards handcuffed backwards, laying there for at least 20 to 25 minutes before they took him to Harlem Hospital. None of them had the heart to just grab his body, put him in a car, and take him to the hospital. All these white shirts were out there. They were in communication with one police plaza, and they decided to let him lay there and die. And they covered the whole thing up. So if they will do that with a black police officer, what do you think they'll do to a black man that's been arrested 31 times? No district attorney is going to put his career on the line or really go all out to go after police officers who killed a guy that's been arrested 31 times.
But then you have, I did a commentary about the case, the Eric Garner case, taking, in my view, a very bad turn really early. And that is that we're hearing about marches, we're hearing about protests, and we're hearing there's a lot of emotional choreography going on, but we're not hearing a call for what it seems to be to me the most fundamental thing, which is a special prosecutor in this case. We know that in Staten Island is home to the largest number of police officers in New York City as a county. We know that there has been a history in Staten Island of hostility. I mean, just plain, trenchant, unvarnished racism. between the police department and law enforcement generally and the African-American and Latino communities in Staten Island. We therefore, it is not unreasonable to regard with some degree of suspicion the prosecution in this case, because, as I said, a full month since this event, and we still have no charges yet. We still have the officers on desk duty, which is unimaginable if it were to apply to regular citizens. So this case has already taken a wrong turn, as far as I'm concerned, and there seems to be a lack of legal strategy in what this case should do, which is to force an entirely different approach and to leverage power that the community does have to create the changes that are necessary. What is your view? Should there be a special prosecutor in this case?
Well, absolutely. There should be a special prosecutor in all questionable police shootings, because time has taught us that district attorneys are not going to prosecute to the full extent of the law police officers that involve itself in unnecessary shootings. Now, I think it's theater when you see the family every week gathering up there in Harlem saying, oh, they just want justice. This is all theater, because this is all out of a playbook. When you consider that there was going to be a major march over the Verrazano, and you know full well that someone like the governor stepped in, because that bridge is a representation of white supremacy, because whites, poor or working class whites, as soon as they got a nice civil service job, they moved to Staten Island. They left Canarsie, Bay Ridge, and all of these places like that, Howard Beach, and they went to Staten Island to live amongst themselves, to get away from black people. And that bridge is the exit. So that bridge, you can say it's the Edmund Pettus Bridge, and that it was going to be held in a certain way that it's never been marched over. So I think that the governor stepped in and told Sharpton that you're not going to be allowed to do it, Andrew Cuomo, and he in turn has flipped it and said, well, the bridge ain't the issue, so they're just going to have a regular march from the site where Eric Garner was killed to the district attorney's office. Reverend Sharpton knows full well that there needs to be a special prosecutor in this case. The feds won't come in as long as Reverend Sharpton, as Malcolm described in the grassroots speech, that these black leaders now, well, they're leading blacks, but as Malcolm called them, black leaders that control the masses and keep everything in order for the white bosses. So the way he described it is clearly what's being done this very day, that black people under control. Donovan is going to do this case if the feds don't take it from him. And if Donovan does the case, it's very easy in Staten Island to go judge shopping and find a friendly judge that will be friendly to the police officers in question. The police officers in question, if they get indicted, can request a bench trial, and everybody goes home happy. And this is what's going to happen. But Reverend Sharpton and them will claim a victory, because the family will get paid. If they play ball and go along with everything, the same thing that happened to Omar Edwards, his wife that he left, and the same thing with Sean Bell, his fiance, you know, the bearer of the children, if they play ball, they will get paid in the end, but there won't be justice. There'll just be economic recompense. That's it.
What, as we come to a close, what, Michael Graves, would you say is the most important thing that people need to know about these shootings and the relationship of between race and policing?
Until we can better control our communities, until we organize our dollars, until we organize our communities, and every black person that's listening to this show should be a part of an organization, until we can put people in office that will follow our agenda, because we don't make enough demands on elected officials. If we can get the right people in office, we can get the right people in the district attorney's office. If we can organize our communities with the correct power, then we can, in turn, go after these rogue cops who just, at their discretion, just shoot unarmed people. And until they go to jail, there's not going to be a change in this behavior until they're doing hard time.
To your mind, within the department, are African Americans and Latinos, the people who come from the communities where these kinds of crimes are occurring, is there enough of a voicing of concern within the department by Black and Latino cops?
Well, put it this way, if Blacks had to wait for the numbers to be right for there to be any type of influence, then there would be no 100 Blacks in law enforcement. There would be no Latino Officers Association. So we are voices. We are those who are like-minded, who get together and try to speak for justice. We have worked together. We have a history of standing up for justice in our own little way. But those small percentages, whether it's on the street or wherever it might be during patrol, is not enough, because you also need outside to work with the inside. And our numbers have to be bigger. If we had the right numbers that was representative of New York City, then our numbers would triple. Because if we're 47% of the voting, and that's just counting the Blacks that say they're Black, this is not the Blacks who speak Spanish. If that, then we well over 60%. Now you're talking, if that was representative in the police department, then whites would not have the free hand that they have right now. So the white brass, the white mayor, and the like would have a serious challenge on its hands if we had the right people in place and the right organizations that were not being paid. You know, these civil rights leaders that are being paid by Fortune 500 companies, support these organizations and control these organizations better if they were not being fed through the same trough that the community activists as well as elected officials, they're all adhering to the same bosses. And that's going to translate into failure for us every time.
And within the department, do you sense that there is a concern among white officers about what's going on? By white officers? Is there enough of a palpable and evident concern?
Well, I don't think so. And the reason why I'm saying that is because every news story you see, you always hear, oh, it's just a few bad apples. A few bad apples cannot do 700,000 illegal stop, question, and frisk. They can't do 600,000 in another year stop, question, and frisk that are illegal, where there's just an abuse of power. That takes a lot of bad apples, not a few. So as long as those numbers are that high and you have one police plaza in an ivory tower dictating down, that trickles down to every police precinct, giving them orders on how to patrol the Black community, because they don't have to be told how to patrol the white community. They know to respect the white community. They know to respect all the different ethnic communities within the white community. And they also know that the leeway they have in patrolling Blacks and Latinos, and it's exercised every day. This is why you'll get an Eleanor Bumpers and you'll get a Baez case, an Anthony Baez case, and these cases like that, because they know that they can get away with it.
Well, I want to thank you for this eye-opening discussion, and I hope it gives people reason to rethink a lot of what they're getting and receiving via the major media about what supposedly is the reality. We will, of course, follow up again. We'll talk to you soon, because I know you have people in Missouri taking a look at what might be happening there, so you will get through your network a better fix than what is being broadcast And, of course, you can tell that I just would not report it because everything right now is suspect. So apart from the fact that we really don't know what is happening, I'm sure that we'll check in with you again and get to understand what really was happening and what really did happen last Saturday. But thank you so much for being with us today, Michael Grace.
Okay, take care, Sister Lee. It's good to see you. And again, we need you in New York.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that compliment. Thank you. Well, we've come to the end of our program today. And I think you would agree that enough was said here, and it is not all that needs to be said, but enough was said to put an entirely different spin on this concept of policing and the impact of race and racism in policing and the consequences to the community. So that very often when you see that people are reacting and it is cast in a particular light, there is a whole different story to be told. There's a whole different history to be told. There's a whole different context to be appreciated. I want to thank you so much for being with me today. You want to keep it right here. Infectious Myth, The Infectious Myth with David Crow is up next. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com or leadstories with Utrice Lead on Facebook. Let me know how these programs are resonating with you. And until tomorrow, I encourage you to tune in tomorrow. It's going to be a hellified program, but I want to thank you for the pleasure and privilege of your company. Down here.